Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of the PreparedX Podcast. This is an interview with David Carlson of Carlson Communications, and we got talking about crisis communications and specifically talking about how to put together crisis communication plans, and this is for corporations. We also got into some of the mistakes that organizations make during crises. So, we refer to a number of cases in this, and David has worked on a number of cases with regards to crisis communication. So he has a lot of examples in this interview. So lots of good information in here. We've worked with David for several years now on a number of projects, and he really is one of the best in this line of work. So I think you're going to enjoy this one. Anyway, that's it. Enjoy the interview with David Carlson. Well, good morning, David, and thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Rob. Nice to be with you. Virtually, anyway.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I guess Calgary this time of year is starting to cool down, and no different here in the Northeast.
Yeah, this is my will be my first extended period in Alberta, Canada, and it's been a lot warmer than I was led to believe would happen. But everybody's warning me it's going to turn on you. They say.
Right.
Beware.
Right. Yeah, no, it's certainly that time of year. So, before we get going here, David, could you spend a few minutes just talking about, where you come from in terms of your career within the world of, sure. Crisis management? Just let the audience, just to frame this before we get into the kind of a Q&A session.
Sure. I've been a communications professional for all my career, which is now over 30 years. And most of that time I've been with various communications firms, international firms, large firms, small firms. Currently I have my own company, Carlson Communications, and I have worked with Rob and PreparedX for some years now, so I'm an associate with PreparedX as well. Part of my work in the past 30 years has been in the area of crisis preparedness, crisis management. And that's really taken me to just about every kind of crisis under the sun, everything from data breaches and cyber attacks, environmental accidents, product recalls, financial problems, high-profile lawsuits, criminal behavior scandals in the boardroom, all kinds of labor disputes, competitive challenges, regulatory challenges. And I've worked with companies in either preparing crisis plans and or managing crises, helping them manage crises when they occur. Companies like the Bechtel, big engineering firms, healthcare organizations like the New York Flood Center, food companies like Cargill, retail restaurants and stores like Dunkin', Donuts, Cadbury Schweppes, Staples, energy companies like Entergy, Repsol, Irving Oil, Canaccord LNG. So, and a list of nonprofits and educational institutions as well. Everybody of every size and shape and anywhere in the world, sooner or later, will experience a crisis.
Right. And it's how they prepare for those events that will, either pull them through it in good stead or will turn the other way and turn their stakeholders and the public against them, depending on how well prepared they are.
And it's always surprising to me, but common to find out that even large companies that should know better don't have a crisis plan. I think that the last statistic I saw on this was about 40% of large companies don't have crisis plans. I saw another statistic just the other day. There was a survey done on small businesses by an insurance company, and they found out that 8 out of 10 small businesses don't have a cyber attack response plan.
Right.
And that's astounding, considering that more than half of them have actually been victimized by cyber attacks.
Right.
So it's amazing to me after, you know, everybody can see what happens to a company's reputation and brand equity in a crisis, that a lot of people still don't do the basic groundwork of having a plan in hand.
Sure. I mean, that really covers off what one of the questions that I had for you with regards to, you know, the importance of organizations having, you know, communication specific and crisis communication specific mm-hmm. plans. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the importance behind that?
Well, to me, there is no real crisis preparedness without a crisis communications plan. Communications is part and parcel of forming the crisis plan overall in the first place. And if you were to have a crisis, communications is part and parcel of the response. You're not just putting out the fire, so to speak. You also have to communicate with the families of victims of the fire, with government officials demanding to know why the fire occurred, shareholders wondering what the damage is going to be to the stock price because of the fire. Most importantly, your employees will want to know how the fire might shut down their operations and perhaps result in layoffs, furloughs, that type of thing. So communications is an essential part of both the crisis plan as well as the crisis management should a crisis occur.
Sure. Within the plan itself, David, what are the core components to a crisis communications plan? How does that get built out?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's probably three core elements that I would mention. First one is you got to get people at all levels of the organization to be able to be sensitive to the vulnerabilities that the organization has and articulate those to the people who are tasked with coming up with a crisis plan. At the top levels of the company to the lowest levels of the company, what's keeping those people up at night? What are the vulnerabilities of the company? And interestingly enough, the whole process of developing a plan is almost as important as the plan itself that results, because often you can reduce those vulnerabilities that have been identified in the processes of developing the plan.
Right.
So getting people at all levels to identify vulnerabilities, number one. Number two, I would say, would be what is the chain of communication? So how would someone find out that a crisis was happening? What if they smell smoke? What are they going to do? And they're going to have to be taught how to report a potential crisis that's occurring, or even an actual crisis that's occurring. Who do they report to? How do they record the incident so they have accurate information? And that will result in the assembly of a crisis response team. And the crisis response team are the group of people who are have the responsibility of guiding the company through the crisis. Ultimately, the head of that crisis response team is going to be the chief executive officer, because they're going to be the ultimate decision maker in the event of a large enough crisis. And thirdly, you want to you don't want your plan just to be generic. You want to identify the most damaging and the most likely crisis scenarios. I mean, you could say, well, the most damaging thing would be a meteor falling through the roof of our factory and destroying everything. That would be damaging. That's not very likely. But there are likely things that could happen that are also the most damaging. And there's going to be a handful of those. And you would want to develop very precise communication strategies, messages, and tactics to deal with those handful of identified highly likely and highly damaging kinds of crisis scenarios.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And then, you know, tying that into what other plans in terms of emergency management or business continuity that the business may have, coordinating communications and operations. You know, do you see that being as an important element of preparing as well, and how, you know, the communication response team, you know, works alongside operations.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you see that even with you see the graphics that FEMA has prepared that show an organization of crisis response team, and you'll see right away that the communications function is right up there at the whole, top level management of the operational side of managing the crisis. So they go hand in hand. There is no overall crisis management without communications working hand in glove with the operational side of crisis management.
Sure. And we certainly see that as well. The core crisis management team is made up of communicators, communications personnel. It's made up of human resources. It's made up of operations, logistics, finance, and certainly legals often involved in that that level of the crisis management team. And communications is obviously a big part of that. In terms of the steps to actually create the plan, so we really talked about the core elements, which are somewhat similar. You mentioned, I think, one of the core elements being that evaluation of those potential risks to the business. Is that where you would start in the development of the plan? And how would that actually take place? You sit down with your core team. Do you work out kind of a framework for that? How would you see that unfolding in terms of those steps in the development of a crisis communications plan?
Yes. Well, after you've identified your vulnerabilities and you've figured out what the communications chain would be, and you've identified who's on your crisis response team, and then you've zoomed in and sort of analyzed the most likely, the most damaging crisis scenarios, you're going to want to actually play out each of those scenarios in some great detail. And as I mentioned earlier, that would entail creating messages to deal with that scenario, communication strategies, who the audiences are that you're most you're going to be most in need of communicating with, and then you're going to have, in addition to that, you're going to need a monitoring system in place to flag potential crises. For example, crises that come through on the internet. Last week, for example, we saw Starbucks had a minor crisis, but a crisis nonetheless, when a video went viral on YouTube of a person accusing Starbucks of making war on Christmas because of the design of their holiday season cup. I don't know if you had a chance to see that, Robin.
Yeah.
It was quite interesting.
I noticed a few,
but it went viral,
few headlines. Sure.
And it reached some sort of a tipping point when, I don't know the exact number in that case, but it reached some sort of a tipping point when Starbucks was really forced to respond. And respond they did in a very constructive way. And I think that they were able to put the accusation that they are making war on Christmas to rest.
Right.
But had they not been vigilant in monitoring and tracking how many hits the tweets in relation to that were getting and how many views there were of the YouTube video that this person made, they might have had lost a lot of time in responding, and it would have grown worse. And monitoring the internet is particularly important for customer-facing retail-type companies and restaurants and things like that. Most of the crises that you see in relation to things going viral on the internet are often because of retail customer facing things where you have an irate customer that posts a video or some other kind of a tweet or a blog or things like that. And it's incumbent to monitor these things and know when to respond and also know when not to respond, because you don't want to dignify some minor thing that's not picking up any traction.
Sure.
So monitoring system is key. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, no, I think we saw something similar a number of years ago with Domino's Pizza, where there was one of their locations somewhere here in the States, an employee was doing various things to the food and acting out, and another employee was recording it, and it went viral on YouTube. and same kind of deal. They had to, you know, scramble around as an organization. And I thought the CEO in that particular case did a fantastic job with his messaging, and they actually utilized social media as well. So it played into their advantage, and you know, they pushed their message out via various channels, and certainly social media was one of them. And he had a really strong and honest and you know, a believable response. And I think, you know, as an organization, they were certainly prepared for that.
Very, very true. I'm familiar with that Domino's Pizza situation. And you're right. They kind of fought fire with fire. The damage was done through social media, and they fought it successfully through social media.
Yes. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to continue about the various steps that after you have a monitoring system in place, one of the most important steps that you can take when creating a plan is to have a section where you consider how you're going to empower your employees. They are your eyes and ears of potential crises. They have to be communicated with so they understand their roles in seeing potential or an actual crisis unfolding. Knowing how to report them promptly and how to record the information. If someone's a receptionist and they get a phone call with somebody saying there's a bomb in the building, they have to be schooled in how to really take notes. Does the person have an accent? Things like that. Whatever the various things that they're supposed to know. They have to be empowered to know what to do and then how to report that incident immediately. So also during crisis management, they're your most important stakeholder audience, because if you neglect to communicate with your employees, you've done a terrible disservice to the managing the crisis effectively, because your employees will then be confused, perhaps fearful. They might start rumors. They're not going to be able to help you carry constructive messages into the community, to their friends and family. So employees have to be part of the crisis plan. And lastly, I would say that, and very, very importantly, that as part of the crisis preparation, you want to cultivate who your third-party supporters are, because during a crisis, they can serve as your proxy spokesperson in the most credible way, much more credible than the CEO saying good things about the company. If you have a respected third party saying positive things that the company acted responsibly and effectively and professionally in handling the crisis, that is the best way to use crisis communications with your third party supporters.
Sure, sure. And so when that plan's developed, then we've been through the various steps. Then it's validation of the plan. Is that a, you know, an exercise? Is that some kind of scenario? You know, you've built those scenarios already because you've been through that that assessment of those vulnerabilities. Is it time then to, you know, bring the organization around the table to actually validate if that plan is viable and roles and responsibilities and how it's actually going to play out in a real event?
Yeah, I mean, it is really crucial to test your plan through conducting crisis exercises. I mean, you don't want to test the plan during an actual crisis,
right,
because
right.
You just don't know if it's going to work, really. But through a regular series of crisis exercises, dealing with various kinds of scenarios, and there are so many different kinds of scenarios. I mean, a scenario of let's say, a hurricane that affects your operations is far different from a security breach through, you know, a computer hacking sort of crisis. So they're very, very different. So you want to test aspects of your plan regularly using the various types of crisis scenarios that you've identified are vulnerabilities for your organization. So, yeah, the exercises are crucial. Know that your plan is as good as and as solid as it possibly could be.
Right. You know, we see this often as well, that the social media side during a crisis is so fast flowing. You know, when we develop, as you know, these scenarios, certainly North America is big for this, and even other parts of the world now. You know, we did some exercises recently in London and Amsterdam. And social media is also, in you know, most crises, is very is relevant very early on, because it can build up steam very quickly, as you know. And so, part of the scenarios that we run, as you know, we often use that social media piece to simulate those various communications that the organization or communication challenges that the organization would have to deal with throughout any type of event. From your standpoint on the social media front, what are some of the biggest challenges that organizations are facing with regards to specifically communications and how they try and deal with whether it's trending on Twitter, whether it's a YouTube video that's had tens of thousands of views within a short period of time? What are the biggest challenges within the organization to to be able to manage those types of new age media, if you will, challenges?
Yes, I think of social media as kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's a very effective way for people to attack the organization. An activist group can be assembled globally in a matter of days, hours even, through social media. On the other hand, the social media enables the company to respond quickly and perhaps dampen unrest that's out there amongst various stakeholder groups. But there's just a lot of, we mentioned earlier how negative video going viral. You mentioned the case with Domino's, and there are a whole bunch of other ones. Applebee's restaurant had a viral video where this was about a year or so ago, where a person in the restaurant did not tip the waitress, and she wrote on the customer wrote on the bill, why I tithe to my Lord, but I don't tithe to waiters and waitresses. So the waitress took a picture of it and put it on YouTube. And that was not a good thing to do, because it identified the credit card information of the person stiffed the waitress.
Yeah.
So the waitress was promptly fired. But then across the country, people fell in line in support of the waitress.
Right.
So all of a sudden, Applebee's restaurant had a tremendous issue on their hand. It went on and on for quite some time. It eventually, after multiple apologies by the restaurant, they reinstated the waitress and explained why they felt that revealing the identity of the customer was a very bad thing,
sure,
and they won't let that happen again. But nonetheless, they had some wounds licking to do after that, and it did hurt their reputation for a period of time. I think it's gone away at this point. But negative videos going viral. Online fraud is a big thing on the internet. You really don't know who's saying something, and it could be fraudulent. A good example of this was during the Gulf oil spill, where somebody had the Twitter handle at BP Global PR. And it was tweeting as if he or she who was doing this were a representative of the company. They were not.
Right. Yeah.
there's all kinds of fraudulent things going on the internet that have to be guarded against and prepared for. People talk about how there's, digital media, online media, social media, and there's the traditional media, New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. Well, really, it's almost one and the same now, because Wall Street Journal and the New York Times are online, and after every article, you have comment sections, and the comment sections are a free-for-all where people can say anything and disparage whatever's written there and disparaging your organization, and somebody else could have a rejoinder to that. It makes it worse than somebody else. So the company at some point has to know when to engage in social media to put a damper on those kinds of things, whether it's the so-called traditional media or online media. It's all kind of blends together nowadays.
Yeah, I think that's why that monitoring that monitoring piece is really important, right? I mean, we have a number of clients that could be impacted by fast-moving events, explosions due to processes within facilities, or oil and gas related challenges, and And one of the biggest things they face is when you've got hundreds of employees on site who may know the policy in terms of social media, don't take pictures. But then you have contractors and you have a whole host of visitors, and then all of a sudden there's an event and people are tweeting and posting pictures, the public from the local road, which is runs by the facility, and all of a sudden the facility is trying to deal with the emergency, but they're getting phone calls from left, right, you know, from all over the place as they're trying to deal with it. And if they don't have that communication element to pass that along to, it becomes very challenging for them.
You just mentioned something that's really important, and it's also one of the biggest challenges about social media is the idea of an employee policy and how to articulate that and other communications function to the employees. It's tricky in addition because not only is the policy going to clearly affect how they're dealing with their computers that they have at work and how they deal online, but every employee certainly has a computer at home where they have their own personal Facebook or Instagram accounts, and they have to be taught to be cautious because they're going to be talking about their employer, even if it's through their own personal Facebook account. So having a policy and articulating that policy and making people understand the importance of it is a very important big challenge that organizations face when it comes to social media. But in any event, companies also should have a visible social media presence to begin
right.
with.
Oh yeah,
because
sure.
that serves as a strong foundation for launching responses if the need arises.
Yeah, I mean that's interesting. You know, there's this online presence now. I was on a flight last year back from the UK, I believe, and it was Virgin Atlantic, and I landed in Boston. Went to get my bag. My bag wasn't there. And so there was a long line, you know, at the Virgin desk, and I was in a hurry. So I said, well, you know, I'll call them on the way, or, you know, kind of deal with it on the way. So I get home and I think to myself, I've got two options here. I've got the 1-800 number, which I know if I call, it's going to take me a while to get through, or I'm going to get passed around, or it's going to be automated, or I could just tweet Sir Richard Branson, right? So I think, and I follow him on Twitter, so I thought, maybe this will get, move things along, quicker. So, just arrived back from Boston, you know, bag didn't arrive with me, tried the first line of defense, which was the, going to the desk and, at Mr. Branson, where's my bag? Within 5 minutes, and this is no word of a lie, within 5 minutes, I get a phone call from a lovely lady with a British accent saying, we're very sorry. Can you give me, your bag number? And, had the tag number, so I gave it to her. We'll be back in touch shortly. And so anyway, straight away within, half an hour later, your bag is on the next flight from London, and then we'll deliver it straight to your house. But very interesting because at that point in time, Mr. Branson had probably, 2, 3, or 4 million followers, maybe more, on Twitter. And as soon as one or two of those those Twitter followers see him being tagged for a missing bag, which is not a big crisis, but it's certainly an opportunity. But what happened? This is what happened afterwards. I thanked him publicly. Thank you, and I copied and I tagged Mr. Branson, saying, great job of communicating well with me. And that's what it's all about. It's about that relationship with your customers and having that strong line of communication. And so then, of course, other people will then see that happy customer, right?
Yeah, that's a great story. I love that story. There's one final thing I would say about challenges is, and I mentioned, policies for employees, but there have been some renowned, infamous cases of CEOs doing just stupid things on the internet and bringing a crisis upon themselves.
Right.
One example is the CEO of Whole Foods. Used a pseudonym to post on the Yahoo Finance message board trying to decrease a competitor's stock price.
Oh, boy.
Somehow, ultimately, this was revealed, and he had some explaining to do.
Sure. Yep. No,
and, and then you get into the whole area of crisis communications called corporate apologies, which is a whole other subset.
I'm not sure how much time we have, but... with regards to, so let's go back to the traditional media, if you will, in terms of, you know, the social media builds up and, you know, traditional media then starts to, you know, get a stake in the game and you get some calls from either local or national if it's a large enough event. You know, if an organization is not prepared, there's going to be that scrutiny. We know that, we've seen that, and that will continue. But does it also present an opportunity for an organization during a crisis? You know, have you seen any cases where, you know, they've, you know, an event has unfolded, but they've, you know, come out of the other end stronger and they've taken the opportunity because they were prepared, because they were ready, because they had their messages and they had built those relationships ahead of time and they had, you know, valued relationships within a community or within their stakeholder base. Have you seen any cases like that in terms of organizations using the crisis as an opportunity to increase whether it's their user base or whether it's improve, or strengthen their reputation during or, you know, after an event? Have you come across anything like that?
Yeah. There were some very good examples of well-handled media relations. JetBlue comes to mind. They had an incident several years ago that they had to cancel a lot of flights for one reason or another, some kind of malfunction. And they did just a very deft job of using the media to get their messages of apology out there, restitution for people who were inconvenienced, pledges to, take responsibility. All the right messages came through the media, and it really helped to maintain their reputation. So that was a great example. Unfortunately, there's so many opposite kinds of examples that were negative. A recent one that comes to mind was the Takata, the Japanese company that makes the emergency airbags. They just simply couldn't have had worse media relations.
Right.
I'd say probably they made the most egregious error the media relations you could possibly have, which was essentially lying to the media, saying that they were going to be cooperative with the Federal Highway Traffic Safety Board, but at the same time refusing to do what the traffic safety board was telling them to do in terms of recalling their airbags. So they were, you know, obviously going to be found out. I don't know how that got through, but it was clearly found out that they were just blatantly lying. And it wasn't just a lie from some mid-level person. It was actually a statement from the chairman of the board,
right,
saying that they were going to cooperate with the National Highway Traffic. So that, of course, has wounded them. I would say for indefinite harm to their reputation.
That's it.
And you see this, you know, things like the Volkswagen diesel emissions issue or the GM tragedies with the ignition switch. These kinds of things are terrible crises, but they could be made much, much worse through just inadequate or, ineffective or just badly handled media relations. But as you say, and I agree, if you do it right, this is where crisis communications really comes to the fore. If you do it right, the media will help carry your constructive, positive messages and does it in a much more credible way than you could do it directly yourself. You have, for example, positive editorial written by a prominent newspaper, let's say, about how you've handled something responsibly. I mean,
right.
That is far more credible to the public than you saying it yourself.
Sure. Yeah, we hear this phrase in the crisis communication or crisis management world, and that's reputational capital. It's building that capital ahead of time with all your stakeholders. You know, one of the things that comes out all of these exercises that we run and out of most crises, when you look at lessons to be learned from the events or lessons to be learned from, you know, the exercises that organizations run, I would say fairly commonly across the board, this is every sector that we've ever worked in. One of the things that organizations can always do better in, and this is an ongoing challenge for them, is stakeholder relationships. And that's, as you mentioned earlier on, all the way from the employees, all the way through to investors and everyone in between that may have a stake, you know, customers, you know, critical vendors, how do we work with those during an event? And so who owns those relationships? And that's one of the biggest challenges, certainly for large organizations, that they find. You know, who owns the relationship and how strong is the relationship? And what if you're not available to have that discussion with that client or with that stakeholder, whoever it may be, during the emergency? You know, do you have somebody that can step in and kind of answer those questions or prepare those messages or start to communicate during that emergency? So I think that leads me on to something in terms of, you know, that some of the biggest challenges that organizations find during a crisis. And as I mentioned, that's one that you know, we see often. But are there any other common across industries, you know, mistakes or, you know, big challenges for organizations during a crisis that you see, you know, either on the communication side or just on the, you know, on the, you know, general crisis management side? Is there anything, any yeah. cases that you can think of or any instances that you've come across where, you know, there's fairly common, you know, two or three things that you see on a regular basis?
Sure. Well, in relation to media relations, and you touched on this just now, is there's going to be a company spokesperson. And one of the biggest mistakes is not having that company spokesperson properly trained and rehearsed before going in front of the media.
Sure.
One of the most important things to convey as part of your delivery of messages is, first and foremost, if you're in a crisis, to show empathy to to actual or even perceived victims
right.
of the crisis. They want you to be human.
Right.
And we see famous examples of people doing the opposite. Tony Hayward of BP during the Gulf spill famously said, "I'd like to get my own life back," as he's standing in front of his yacht.
Right.
I mean, that was the wrong message.
Yeah.
And it's often the case where CEOs believe that they know the media and they can handle themselves, but that's a mistake. I believe that even, say, the president of the United States goes in front of Congress and the world to deliver State of the Union. That person's going to be rehearsing it beforehand, or
right.
should be, and I believe that they do. There has to be proper media training, and not having it is a very common mistake because you can really step in it at the wrong time in front of millions and millions of people, and digging out of that hole could take some doing. So that's one of the most serious mistakes. Another one I touched on earlier is not considering your employees to be a very high priority stakeholder audience. If you ignore them, they're going to really not just not support you, it's going to be the opposite. You're going to have lowered their productivity. You've lowered their confidence in you as management. You've created disgruntlement, confusion, and fear. They might even end up passing damaging information on to your detractors or competitors
right.
if they haven't been properly communicated with.
Yep.
So that's a common mistake. They're often considered an afterthought when people, organizations are in the throes of a crisis. They
oh,
say,
yeah.
"Oh, we got to get out to the media.
Yeah.
We got to get to, you know, the government regulators and to the shareholders."
Yeah.
And they forget that their employees are their most important audience.
Yeah.
So another common mistake is refusing to talk to the media. You know, that's this used to be more common, I would think, than it is now. I think companies have learned the hard way that if they don't tell the story, someone else is going to tell the story for them, because
yep.
the news media is this open maw that has to be filled. So if you know, if you're not going to talk to the media, you can just imagine the newscaster standing in front of your shuttered company door saying XYZ Corporation refused to comment.
Right.
So you may as well just have a neon sign flashing above his head on your company door saying guilty, guilty,
right.
guilty.
Right. Yep.
You've got to talk to the media. The rule is, during a crisis, tell it first, tell it fast, and tell it accurately.
Yep.
And do it with empathy. Be human. And I'd say the third mistake I would just say really just bad crisis planning, just not cultivating good third-party supporters well in advance of a crisis, not establishing what the employees' responsibilities are and identifying a crisis and reporting a crisis. Bad crisis planning may even be worse than no crisis planning.
Right, right.
It's just a terrible mistake, and it's all too common.
Yeah, you mentioned just going back to empathy there. I think just going back to the Domino's pizza situation. I think, and I wrote a blog on this at the time. Within the first, I think it was like 7 seconds, or maybe even not as far as 10 seconds. The first thing he said is, I'm sorry, we're sorry. And so that was the very first thing that, he got across in his messaging. It was very well articulated, and they may have had some professional help with messaging, but his delivery was honest, and it seemed to be scripted, but, from an untrained eye, from the public's eye, which is Domino's Pizza's, core audience, it came across as really genuine. And really honest about the issue, and actually ended up writing at the end of the blog there that this is the type of person that I would want to follow as a leader. That's how strong he came across to me personally. That was my personal opinion on this one particular statement that is about 2 minutes long, one particular short video that he did. And I think he did a fantastic. He hit all the right buzzwords, and you mentioned employees there. That was a big part of his statement. He was talking about the thousands of employees around the world and caring for them. So very interesting how these messages are pieced together. And again, you can do a lot of that planning. The last point you mentioned there is planning ahead of time. You can have those messages crafted ahead of time for some of your more significant and major challenges. So that saves you time on the day of the actual crisis itself, when you're scrambling around doing other things.
Right. And then the scenarios that you've really drilled into with strategies, when the event actually occurs, it's not going to be exactly the same, but you will have done enough work where you've saved yourself a lot of time and effort. One more point about the CEO from Domino's, which I think you've articulated very well. There's an adage that's very helpful, I think, for crisis communication. I think it's attributed originally to Teddy Roosevelt. And it says, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And to me, that says it all when it comes to talking to the public,
right,
but actually any stakeholder during a crisis. They want you to be human first and foremost. Otherwise, they won't hear your messages. I was had the experience of being with a client that was an asphalt company that was had some bad odors emanating from the factory, and there was a lot of complaints that resulted in a big town hall meeting on camera, and the company had prepared a scientist who had a slideshow who was going to basically show that the odors were not harmful to health, as was alleged by the opponents and activists who were going up against the company. So essentially, the attitude of the scientists was, you people don't know what you're talking about, and let me have my first slide, and I'm going to show you what the chemicals are involved here, and you'll see you have nothing to worry about. He didn't address the human element first,
right,
acknowledging that people were upset and afraid, and he was roundly booed off the stage,
yeah,
and while the cameras were rolling. It was just a perfect example of how he didn't show empathy, and it was incredibly damaging to the company.
It's interesting. I heard something similar for an oil company, I believe, or oil and gas firm, and they had to go in to speak in front of a similar group, but it was a First Nations type group, or First Nations group.
Uh-huh.
And apparently they flew in on a helicopter with two off-duty police officers who came in with them, all dressed in suits. and they come into this town hall, and immediately everybody's, you fly in on your helicopter with your security, and you come here into our community wanting to do business. Apparently it didn't go down well, and I don't think the meeting even got off the ground. So, yeah, you've got to understand your audience, I think, and in this case, they did not. So,
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to thank you for your...
Well, I was just going to...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to just say that there is a lot of research, actually, on behavioral science-based research that shows a lot of guidelines on how to get on the side of your audience. And it goes down to details such as what women should wear or not wear, what men should wear or not wear, depending on if it's a scientist, if it's a CEO, that they found that different kinds of clothing makes a difference in how your messages will be received.
Right. Yeah. No. This has been just fantastic. I think we had a great conversation here today, and I just want to thank you for your time. I know you're putting together an ebook that will probably be ready by the time we have this posted, so we'll make sure that information is within the show notes for this particular podcast. Any final comments for the audience, David, before we head out?
Just to say that the operational crisis plan and the communications crisis plan are really two sides of the same coin, that you have to have both. And I would just end by saying that the guiding rule for crisis communications is you got to tell it first, you got to tell it fast, you got to tell it accurately, and you got to be human.
Thank you very much. Well, again, thank you very much, David. And, we'll be chatting to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Bye. Well, that's it for episode 4. I do hope you've enjoyed this interview. If you did enjoy it, please feel free to share this podcast. Also, as you know, or if you don't know, there's lots of really informative information in our biannual newsletter. You can sign up for that via our website, preparedx.com, and that's preparedx.com/connect. Also, we have our blog, which is again on our .com site/blog. Some great information around crisis management, business continuity exercises, crisis communications. So please feel free to check that out. And that's it for this time. We hope you've enjoyed episode 4 of the PreparedX podcast. Stay safe and have an enjoyable day wherever you are in the world. Thank you.